Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
I was 28 years old, and things were going in a promising enough direction. I had a solid corporate job, a great group of friends, and a wonderful boyfriend named Matt, who, unbeknownst to me then, would become my husband. My creative life was starting to take off. I started Phantasmophile, a tiny corner of the internet where I blogged about art I dug that had a fantastical or magical bent to it. And I had just joined a Brooklyn collective called Observatory. At our humble one-room space, we took turns curating events and art exhibitions about arcane and unusual topics. And I was the resident occultist. I had no problem being public about my interest in magic as a concept. But my belief in magic as a guiding force of my life? That felt like something one didn't talk about in mixed company. Matt and my closest confidants were aware of my thaumaturgical thinking to some extent, but I otherwise kept it largely under wraps, my own clandestine oculus I'd peer through only when I was sure that no one else was staring back. For a while, that was sufficient. And then one day, it wasn't. I can't pinpoint the exact moment. I just know that one season, I suddenly started shedding my skin, wriggling out of my old sleeve of being so I could better extend my limbs. Up until that point, most everything I knew about witchcraft I'd learned from reading. Say what you will about witches, but we are a literary bunch. Witch tales often feature dusty old tomes and wordy scrolls stained by time and tea. My own library of spells and esoterica had outgrown my shelves, and my drawers were overflowing with journals and papers scribbled with notes about things I'd learned. My spiritual guides weren't just those on the ethereal plane. They were also the searching writers who came before me and put line after line down on paper, a trail of lettered breadcrumbs that I followed with gratitude. But in the summer of 2009, I found myself pining for more, a teacher, a group, a tribe, a space where I could bloom and find belonging. I felt a call to find the others, as Timothy Leary famously said, though in my case, I was seeking those both like me and not like me. People who knew more, who knew differently, who would help me wind my own way through the vast, wild wood. What I was looking for, I realized, was a coven. Okay, then. But were those even real? How does one find such a thing? And once you do, how do you know if it's the right coven? And all of that is a rather moot point, to be sure, if the coven in question doesn't covet you back. It seemed I was going to need some help. To complete most of my spells, I usually leave an offering at a beloved tree in my neighborhood. Its trunk splits into three large branches, so it makes me think of a crossroads or triple goddess. I call it my Hecate tree. It's relatively out in the open, on a street I don't live on, in front of a brownstone I don't live in. It is one of many trees on the block, and the usual passerby probably wouldn't single it out as particularly remarkable, other than the occasional ensorcelled remains I leave behind. But it does the job insofar as it is a beautiful bit of nature to which I feel a distinct link. I know it as a holy, friendly place, and it knows me now too. This isn't where I found myself walking to on that summer evening, though. I was asking for something that felt larger, so I needed to make a grander gesture. Spell work is a relationship, and it demands an exchange. What you get out of it is what you put into it. And this time, I knew I had to go farther than my usual route. And so, that July evening, I found myself on a magic mission to Prospect Park with a Tupperware full of flower petals and a batch of big wishes. I walked past the playground and the band shell and the dog beach and the baseball fields and entered its arboreal heart. I finally stopped at a shady clearing that looks as if it's out of a Camelot tale or a Thomas Cole painting. Most people don't associate New York City with waterfalls, but there are actually a few truly lovely ones tucked away if you know where to find them. I arrived at this urban idyll, a paved bridge of a sort, surrounded on all sides by old foliage and solemn stones and the sound of a great churning. I stood in silence, matching my breathing to the air, slipping into that level of consciousness that feels rooted in the present, but splendidly endless. My lids were shut, and I cast off, ready to be heard. I made my motions, gave my words over to the water, then took fistfuls of petals and let them fall too. If there is indeed a goddess, I believe she dwells there, and was pleased by my entreaty, or at least filled with sweet pity. When you send out a great call, how do you know if it is spirit or nature that answers? Maybe there's no difference at all. Maybe grace is green. When I was done, the park felt as if it had slid into another dimension, gentler, but somehow also more alive, as if millions of tiny eyes had suddenly fluttered open. Mystics have identified some locations as thin places, spots that seem as if they exist between the earthly and spiritual realms. I think this sylvan sliver of Brooklyn would make their list. During those long minutes when I wandered back in the direction of home, the park felt somehow lifted, shifted, and perennially dusk-lit. The next day, I went to work, same building as always, same cubicle per usual. But something in me felt changed and expectant. I went out on my lunch break, walking through Soho, sensing some sort of pull eastward, past 6th Avenue, past Thompson, past Worcester, past Mercer, left turn on Broadway, right on Spring. And then I found myself entering the Open Center, an educational space dedicated to holistic healing and alternative thought. Their small bookshop had been a great resource for me in the past, but this time I didn't quite know what I was looking for. "Do you have any books on witchcraft?" I asked the man working there. "Well," he said, "we don't like to call it that here." He lowered his voice. "But we do have a teacher who I think fits the bill. You'll find her classes listed in our catalog under herbalism, but she is definitely a witch." And he placed one of her books in my hand. This wasn't the answer that I had in mind. I tried to be thoughtful about what I put into my body, sure, but my interest in herbs was minimal at best. I barely cooked, my apartment had no outdoor space, let alone a garden, and I was hardly the Birkenstock-wearing sort. Still, I sensed that this was a message worth paying attention to. I didn't know where it would lead me, only that I was intrigued enough to take a step in the direction I was being pointed. And so I started studying with Robin Rose Bennett, the Green Witch of New York City. First, it was months of classes at the center, the art of herbal medicine making, healing spices, herbs for the nervous and digestive systems. All were hugely informative regarding various plants' effects on human physiology, and each was also laced with Robin's own brand of plant spirit teachings. Her classes weren't lectures. Rather, they were interactive sessions filled with hands-on medicine making, explorations of each plant's energy, poetic riffs on tree and flower magic, and even an occasional song. I was loving what I was learning, but I was also moved by the other students, who were all different ages and from a variety of backgrounds, but who shared a desire to live in more mindful, earth-centric ways. I felt as if my seams were being stitched back together, and old, forgotten wounds got sealed back up with honey. It was a homecoming, and I knew that I was here to stay. One day in class, Robin mentioned that she ran a private apprenticeship circle, a group of women she would take under her wing for a period of 3 years. "You have to write a statement of intent if you are interested in applying," she said. "I only have 13 women per circle." It would begin in the spring of 2010. This was the coven I had been searching for. I felt it in my herbally fortified bones. The spell had worked. I sometimes call those 3 years my stint in Witch Scouts because it felt a bit like being in a wilderness troop. We learned to forage for herbs in parks and on sidewalks. We went on long treks through the woods and identified different flowers, ferns, and fungi. We learned how to make tinctures, infusions, and salves. Which leaves stop a bug bite from itching? Which herbs to drink in order to soothe anxiety or keep blood sugar levels steady? But much of our work was also supernatural. We cast magic circles. We meditated. We communed with plant guides. We honored the moon. We did rituals to mark the seasons, as well as milestones in each apprentice's life. Robin was our leader, but every one of us got our moment to be in the center. We took turns holding space for each other, bearing witness to each woman's growth and unfolding. We shared our stories with one another, and whatever we brought to circle was received without judgment. It was a container that could hold anything and anyone. We were a diverse group, varied in our bodies and our life experiences, but we were linked beneath it all, our own mycelial network. Over those 3 years, I saw the other women change. I watched them grow stronger, get louder, start to heal. And I began to develop a different sort of power myself, the kind that comes with letting down defenses and letting go. I broadened my concept of who I was. I could be independent and interdependent, unique and united. I could be part of something and still be whole. Most dictionaries state that the word coven comes from the Latin convenere, or to come together, and is related to the word convene. It was brought into popular vernacular by the infamous scholar Margaret Murray, whose 1921 book, The Witch Cult in Western Europe, posited that many of the confessions of alleged witches during the trials should be taken at face value, and that the accused were in fact members of an ancient fertility cult. About the word coven itself, Murray writes, "The special meaning of the word among the witches is a band or company who were set apart for the practice of the rites of the religion and for the performance of magical ceremonies. In short, a kind of priesthood. She also wrote extensively about the persistence of the number 13 in covens, citing transcripts of various witch trial confessions and cataloging examples of 13-person witch groups in the appendix of her book. One of her primary resources is the transcript of Isabel Gowdy, a Scottish woman who confessed to being a witch in 1662 and supplied her accusers with many details about her practices, including the statement that there are 13 persons in Ilk Coven. As Murray saw it, Gowdy and the other accused witches were simply recounting the facts about an old religion that the church was trying desperately to snuff out. Murray believed that at one time, this witch religion, or Dianic cult, as she called it, worshipped a deity that could take on the form of women, men, and beasts. She theorized that in medieval times, it was most often a man dressed as an animal who would represent the god during the witch's rituals. He was the leader of the coven, and she surmised that it was this figure who was rebranded as the devil by the Catholic Church. She believed that a typical public gathering was called a Sabbath, and this was, quote, possibly a derivative of sébattre, to frolic, a very suitable description of the joyous gaiety of the meetings, unquote. The coven, by her estimation, was made up of those 13 individuals who led the rituals for the wider community. More private rites were carried out during what she referred to as an espit, which she described as a more exclusive meeting for the coven alone. Their chief festivals happened at the cross-quarter days, which she referred to as May Eve, November Eve, Candlemas Day, and Lammas Day. Practices included feasting, dancing, sexual rites, sacrifices, and prayers to their deity to bring fertility to their community. In academic and pagan circles alike, Murray has become a controversial figure, for her research has been widely discredited. Though her book is heavily footnoted, with many excerpts of trial confessions included throughout to prove her hypotheses, several scholars over the years have accused her of cherry-picking the examples that supported her theories and disregarding the rest. She has also been criticized for treating the trial transcripts as reliable source material in the first place, since so many of the confessions were obtained under torture and extreme psychological duress, and recorded by untrustworthy scribes. Because of this, her ideas about the existence of real witch cults in early modern Europe have been largely written off. Still, her impact on the collective conception about witches and covens cannot be overstated. In 1929, she wrote the entry on witchcraft for the Encyclopedia Britannica and incorporated her theories into it as if they were facts. This remained unchanged until 1969, essentially defining witch history for two generations of English-speaking people based on her own imaginings. Murray's second book, The God of the Witches, was aimed at a more general audience when it was published in 1933. This book expanded her ideas, toned down some of the more gruesome aspects of witch cult to make the cult's practices more palatable, and delved deeper into exploring what she called the Horned God, which she believed was a male deity that had been worshipped cross-culturally since the Paleolithic age. Pan and the Christian Devil were just two examples of this, according to her thinking. While it's true that both the witch cult in Western Europe and the God of the Witches fizzled out rather quickly when they first appeared on the scene, They each got a second life when they were republished after World War II. The concept of reviving or reconstructing British pagan traditions had been slowly gaining popularity in the decades prior. But after the devastation of the war, appetite for books like Murray's exploded as a reeling nation looked for ways to heal and reassert its identity and ideals. In the late 1940s, Murray's romantic vision of nature-worshipping witches found renewed interest and a much larger audience, and The God of the Witches became a bestseller. That the inner sanctum of academia had discounted Murray's ideas didn't seem to matter, for her writing had already captured the public's imagination, including that of the man who would become the founding father of modern witchcraft, Gerald Gardner. If Margaret Murray planted one of the witchcraft revival's largest seeds, then Gardner was one of its primary cultivators. The origin story of the modern religion of Wicca is nebulous, but there is no doubt that Gardner was its primary steward, if not its outright inventor. Gardner was a former owner or manager of tea and rubber plantations throughout the English colonies of Ceylon, North Borneo, and Malaya. He was also fascinated with mysticism and studied the magic of local communities where he was living, as well as the various systems of Freemasonry, spiritualism, and other occult systems a la mode. Additionally, he was an avid antiquarian and had an extensive collection of weapons and artifacts with a preponderance of ritual knives. He retired to London in 1936 at the age of 52, but in 1938, he and his wife moved to Highcliffe, near England's New Forest, to protect his collection of antiques against looming war. He stated that he was inducted into the New Forest Coven in the nearby town of Christchurch in 1939 by a woman he called Old Dorothy Clutterbuck, the veracity of which has since been debated, as there is scant evidence that the real Dorothy Clutterbuck, a wealthy local, was a magic practitioner. Nonetheless, his involvement with witchcraft deepened over the next several years. One remarkable story about this time is that of Operation Cone of Power, a ritual that Gardner's coven allegedly participated in after France fell to the Nazis in 1940. Concerned that England would be next in the line of attack, the witches gathered in the forest on August 1st, the pagan holy day Lammas, to raise a cone of magically charged energy for the purpose of thwarting Hitler. According to Gardner, they raised a cone four times that night and projected the thoughts, "You cannot cross the sea," and "not able to come," into Hitler's mind. He also said that the exertion of dancing and chanting for hours naked in the cold proved too much for some of the witches, causing a few of the elders to die a few days later. The operation was otherwise effective, by his estimation. As he later wrote coyly in his 1954 book, Witchcraft Today, "I am not saying that they stopped Hitler. All I say is that I saw a very interesting ceremony performed with the intention of putting a certain idea into his mind, and this was repeated several times afterwards. And though all the invasion barges were ready, the fact was that Hitler never even tried to come." How Gardner went from a coven member to the father of Wicca is a tangled tale that's too long to recount in detail here. Suffice it to say, he was greatly influenced by other magically concerned writers of his day. His first two books, A Goddess Arrives, 1940, and High Magic's Aid, 1949, were witchcraft-themed novels, the later of which included fictionalized accounts of the rituals he was doing with his own coven many of them clear adaptations of Margaret Murray's theories into story form. Gardner also met with the controversial occultist Aleister Crowley several times in May of 1947. It seems that Gardner was considered a likely successor to lead the Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO, the magical initiatory society of which Crowley was the head and Gardner was also a member. These plans never came to pass, however, and when Crowley died in December of that year, Gardner was otherwise preoccupied. During the latter half of the 1940s, Gardner kept a private book in which he wrote down rituals, readings, and other instructions for his own form of witchcraft to be practiced by his coven. His Book of Shadows, as he called it, was a veritable mashup of other texts, including biblical verses, the Mather's edition of the Key of Solomon, the Goetia, a work on the Kabbalah, three different books by Crowley, the Waite-Smith Tarot Pack, and one or two unidentified grimoires, according to Ronald Hutton. Charles Godfrey Leland's 1899 book, Aradia, or The Gospel of the Witches, was borrowed from as well. Gardner's own contributions were an emphasis on nudity. He was a big proponent of naturism, or being naked outdoors, as a therapeutic means for keeping the body healthy, as well as the use of physical binding and flagellating to purify the coven members and induce ecstatic states, though he insisted these not be too painful. The Book of Shadows was added to and edited into the 1950s, and it ultimately evolved to become more egalitarian. Where his early writings presumed a male magus would be initiating a female witch into the coven, later amendments have a high priestess and high priest conducting rites at the same level, as well as more language about goddesses and feminine power. Much has been made of the supposedly high kink quotient in some of Gardner's mystical rites. Not only were all of the practices supposed to be done in the nude and with such accoutrements as ropes and knives, but intercourse itself was considered the great rite, either done literally or represented symbolically. Whether or not these practices were the personal expression of a randy senior citizen, the evolved acts of sexual liberation between consenting adults, or merely time-tested physiological techniques for raising blood flow and inducing trance states, depends on your point of view. Gardner himself wrote that he didn't think it fair to call witches disappointed perverts. They may truly be said to be followers of a primitive religion already disappearing. Thanks in large part to the spiritualist community, England's Witchcraft Act of 1735 and Vagrancy Act of 1824 were both repealed in 1951 and replaced by the less harsh Fraudulent Mediums Act, which essentially legalized witchcraft and mediumship so long as they weren't being used to deceive paying customers. This is one of the reasons you'll often see any sort of spiritual services or items sold with the disclaimer, "for entertainment purposes only." With the passing of this legislation, Gardner felt emboldened to become more public with his interests, if not his outright beliefs. His 1954 book, Witchcraft Today, was his first published nonfiction work. In it, he recounts his experiences of witnessing the modern practice of this primitive religion of witchcraft. He uses the word Wicca, spelled W-I-C-A, for the first time in print, saying it means wise people, and refers to those who practice the age-old rites. This was later adapted to Wicca, W-I-C-C-A, though Gardner didn't use that term himself to describe his new old religion. He also echoes much of Margaret Murray's writings, saying that the concept of the satanic witch was a result of a smear campaign by the church. Quote, "Witches do not kiss the devil's posterior. First, because they never kiss anyone's posterior, and secondly, because the devil is never there for anyone to kiss." Unquote. In regard to covens, he writes that they traditionally consist of 12 witches and a leader, probably because it is a lucky number and because there are 13 moons in a year. He goes on to state that an ideal coven consists of 6 perfect couples, plus the priest or priestess, and that the couples should be husbands and wives, or at least betrothed. Certainly, by today's standards, this comes across as jarringly heteronormative and old-fashioned. But in the 1950s, to put women on equal footing with men in any regard, whether spiritually, socially, or sexually, was quite progressive. And just as significantly, Wicca's worship of both a god and a goddess was truly revolutionary from the perspective of Western religious history. Gardner's writings about working magic in a group are also striking. In Witchcraft Today, he describes a witch as someone who can stimulate or even create more of his or her aura or personal electromagnetic field. And he says that when witches work together, their united wills can project this as a beam of force. Later in the text, he uses the anti-Hitler Operation Cone of Power ritual as an example of this, though he refers to it here as an operation called Sending Forth. This gathering was an exception to the 13-member rule, he says, because they needed as many people as possible to do such a large working. There is much about this book I find endearing, yet it is also factually muddled. Margaret Murray wrote the introduction for it, saying that the rites therein are a true survival and not a mere revival copied out of books. It's an ironic claim, considering that we now know that many of Gardner's practices were based on precisely that sort of cutting and pasting from a variety of sources, including Murray's own writings. Furthermore, throughout Witchcraft Today, Gardner assumes an objective, outsider's tone. The witches are described as they rather than we, and he positions himself as a witness rather than a participant or even an active creator of said traditions. Only near the end of the book does he say, "I am a humble member of a coven. I am not its head or leader in any way, and I have to do what I am told." I bring all of this up not in order to reject the importance of Gardner's vast contribution to religious life. The fact is that he was a profoundly progressive, wildly inventive human being, and he opened a tributary of alternative spirituality that continues to inspire people, including me, to this day. While he was certainly borrowing heavily from other writers, some of whom, like Margaret Murray, were subject to their own flights of fancy, I believe that he believed that he was truly tapping into an ancient vein of lost wisdom. By synthesizing an impressive amount of scholarship, sentiment, and self-experimentation, Gardner and his cohorts essentially took the practices of earlier secret societies, including Freemasonry, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and the OTO, and revamped them with an eye toward an idealized pagan past, free of sexual hang-ups and patriarchal oppression. And regardless of Gardner's original intentions, the work that he and his coven did helped catalyze a movement. The plot of the Wicca and modern paganism story takes many twists and turns beyond his output, and to his great credit, he encouraged people to adapt and add to his own ideas. In fact, his coven's high priestess, Doreen Valiente, is responsible for penning many of Wicca's most famous and divinely feminine incantations, including a rewrite of what is now commonly known as the Charge of the Goddess. Feminist witchcraft leader Starhawk's rewrite of the rewrite from the 1970s is perhaps the best-known version. Covens of all types popped up throughout England and America during the 1960s and 70s, with new styles and leaders following suit. Witchcraft was reframed as a practice that was alive and accessible to anyone who felt drawn to learn it. Most significantly of all, Gardner further cemented two crucial ideas into popular consciousness. First, that witches are positive and holy beings, not diabolical at all. And second, that their powers increase when working with other like-minded or like-spirited individuals, and that this pooled, transformative energy can be directed toward achieving a shared goal. It's true that during Gardner's time at least, Wiccan covens seem to be primarily concerned with honoring nature and its deities, as well as overseeing each member's individual magical development. Of more outward, politically minded rituals done by witches in his day, Operation Cone of Power is the one that is most usually cited, presumably because he wrote about it himself. That said, he does end Witchcraft Today by surmising, "I think witches could perform similar rites to influence the brains of those who may control the hydrogen bomb." It's unclear whether or not he and his coven later attempted to do such a working. Still, Gardner's model of a group of people pooling their magical energy and directing it toward a shared political goal was adopted by the countercultural movement in the United States, albeit in a manner that was as cheeky as it was purposeful. A demonstration in protest of the Vietnam War was planned at the Lincoln Memorial for the fall of 1967. Activists Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman decided this was the perfect opportunity for an even bigger spectacle. Hoffman had already been making a name for himself as a trickster who used elements of absurdism and guerrilla theater to bring attention to socio-political causes and disrupt the status quo. Inspired in part by the Gary Snyder poem, "A Curse on the Men in Washington, Pentagon," Rubin and Hoffman realized that doing a magic ritual would make people sit up and take notice. They decided to oversee a mass exorcism of the Pentagon, followed by a collective working to levitate it 22 feet off the ground, though the government ended up giving them a permit for only 10 feet. They enlisted Ed Sanders, frontman of the mystically leaning New York City protest band The Fugs, to help lead the exorcism. Sanders, in turn, consulted with underground filmmaker and all-around occult expert Harry Smith to craft the ritual. Word spread about the plan, and it was certainly a draw for some of the estimated 100,000 protesters who showed up in Washington, D.C. on October 21, 1967. After music and speeches, the march went from the Lincoln Memorial across the Potomac River via the Arlington Memorial Bridge, past the Arlington National Cemetery, and down to the Pentagon. There, in the north parking lot, Ed Sanders and the Fugs performed their exorcism from a flatbed truck. As Sanders told Arthur Magazine in 2004, "Harry Smith told me about consecrating the four directions, surrounding it, circling it, using elements of earth, air, fire, and water, alchemical symbols to purify the place, to invoke certain deities, and so on. So I sing-songed a whole retinue of deities past and present, imaginary and real, to summon the strength to exorcise this place. It was part real, part symbolic, part wolf ticket, part spiritual, part secular, part wishful thinking, and part anger. and it had humor. You gotta have the universal humor. And since I knew Indo-European languages, I learned this Hittite exorcism ritual. I actually put together a decent exorcism. The entire chant was eventually recorded under the title Exorcising the Evil Spirits of the Pentagon, October 21st, 1967. Its crescendo, a repetition of the phrase, "Out, demons, out." As part of the ritual, Sanders also announced that there would be a grope-in, wherein couples would engage in a rite of love on the lawn, which did indeed take place, if in smaller numbers than the organizers perhaps originally envisioned. Hoffman hadn't been able to get a permit for protesters to encircle the Pentagon, which was to be a crucial component of levitating the building. But other actions took place, including Mayan healers sprinkling cornmeal in magic circles and the poet Allen Ginsberg uttering mantras. Occult filmmaker Kenneth Anger was also in attendance, though by his account, he thought the others were show-offs, creating more of a circus than a meaningful anti-war gesture. He chose to do his own spells rather than participate in the group activities. All in all, the entire scene made quite an impression. As Norman Mailer described it in the chapter, The Witches and the Fugs, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Armies of the Night, "Now the witches were here, and rites of exorcism and black terrors of the night, hippies being murdered. Yes, the hippies had gone from Tibet to Christ to the Middle Ages. Now they were revolutionary alchemists." Well, thought Mailer, that was all right. He was a left conservative himself. Out, demons, out. Out, demons, out. Certainly, all of this spellcraft was as sensationalist as it was earnest, arguably more so. As to its efficacy, it would take another 7.5 years for the war to end. Still, many point to the march as a key element in raising public outcry. U.S. military analyst Daniel Ellsberg said, "The idea of levitating the Pentagon struck me as a great idea because the idea of removing deference from any of these institutions is very, very important. And this is, of course, the kind of thing that Abbie Hoffman understood very instinctively." Ellsberg would go on to release the Pentagon Papers in 1971, 4 years after the protest, adding more pressure on the U.S. government to pull out of Vietnam. Even though the Pentagon may not have been physically levitated, the spell still brought results. As Allen Ginsberg put it, "The levitation of the Pentagon was a happening that demystified the authority of the military. The Pentagon was symbolically levitated in people's minds in the sense that it lost its authority, which had been unquestioned and unchallenged until then." Group ritual with a shared intention had shifted perceptions then, if not literal foundations. Perhaps that was magic enough. During this period, the women's movement was lifting off in the States. Abbie Hoffman and his band of tricksters would go on to call themselves the Yippies. Their group was the Youth International Party, or YIP. And their activist theatrics continued, if not quite as obviously occult-themed. But another collective, this time made up of all women, took a page out of Hoffman's Pentagon protest playbook and continued to combine magical shenanigans with political intent. Robin Morgan, Florica Remetier, Naomi Jaffe, Peggy Dobbins, Judith DeFette, Bev Grant, Marsha Patrick, Cynthia Funk, and other former members of the New York Radical Women Activist Organization found the witch to be an ideal conduit for their message about female liberation. She was a symbol they could weaponize to illustrate the chronic pervasiveness of sexism through the ages and across various social spheres. She was also in keeping with the Yippies' effective approach of creating friction while having fun. After all, who better than a witch to cause a stir? And so, with their first public action on Halloween of 1968, the feminist activist group called WITCH, Witch, was born. Its members donned witch costumes, replete with brooms and pointy black hats, and did a public ritual performance of hexing the New York Stock Exchange. Did it work? Well, as Gloria Steinem wrote about the incident in New York Magazine, a coven of 13 members of Witch demonstrates against that bastion of white supremacy, Wall Street. The next day, the market falls 5 points. The glue that the witches added to the locks of the New York Stock Exchange doors also added a bit of whammy, no doubt. Another noteworthy witch action was to disrupt the first annual bridal fair at Madison Square Garden in 1969 to fight what they perceived as the dark forces of the wedding industrial complex. A flyer announcing the protest invited the public to bring posters, brooms, costumes, consciousness, anger, witches' brew, love, bridal gowns, tambourines, hexes, laughter, solidarity, and alternatives. Several of the women infiltrated the convention, where they hexed the vendors and sponsors and let loose a flurry of white mice on the showroom floor. Witches' activities gained traction thanks to its mix of witchy wit and gutsy political theatrics. As co-founder Robin Morgan wrote of the collective, its insouciance was undeniable. Soon, other witch groups sprang up around the country, even as far away as Tokyo, though their operations varied. The acronym's meaning fluctuated, initially standing for Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, a tongue-in-cheek title created before the word terrorist held the weighty connotation it does now. Later iterations included Women Incensed at Telephone Company Harassment, Women Interested in Toppling Consumption Holidays, and Women Inspired to Tell Their Collective History. They were mischievous in their approach, but dead serious in their goals. And while they were more interested in playing with the provocative power of symbols than they were in doing actual witchcraft, their manifesto left room for both. Quote, "Witch is an all-woman everything. It's theater, revolution, magic, terror, joy, garlic flowers, spells. It's an awareness that witches and gypsies were the original guerrillas and resistance fighters against oppression, particularly the oppression of women down through the ages." Unquote. Furthermore, there was no governing body or gatekeeper of the group, and any woman who shared their values could be a member and take part in the witchcraft. Quote, "There is no joining witch. If you are a woman and dare to look within yourself, you are a witch. You make your own rules. You are free and beautiful. You can be invisible or evident in how you make your witch self known. You can form your own coven of sister witches, 13 is a cozy number for a group, and do your own actions. Your power comes from your own self as a woman and is activated by working in concert with your sisters. The power of the coven is more than the sum of its individual members because it is together." Unquote. Arguably, this spirit of togetherness is what made Women's Lib so vital overall. The women who took part in the second wave feminist movement were certainly sparked by reading books like Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, but it was in-person conversations via consciousness-raising groups that proved to be truly transformative. For the first time, many women were realizing that their feelings of frustration, oppression, and pain were not abnormal. They got together to share personal stories about their own experiences of womanhood, including discussions about usually hushed-up topics like abortion and rape. Participants in these groups realized that they weren't alone, and they began to let go of the secrecy and shame that surrounded the truth of their own lives. While not every feminist consciousness-raising group would have called itself a coven the way the members of Witch chose to, it's a word that is apt nonetheless. These women learned that by convening within a circle of trust and freely sharing their beliefs, they could become stronger and more liberated individuals. Moreover, they proved that by joining forces and aiming their combined focus at an intended objective, they could make significant change in the wider world.
Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace, for all of us imprisoned, circle for release. Circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace, for all of us imprisoned. Circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for imprisoned, circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle whole. Circle round for freedom, circle round for peace, for all of us imprisoned, circle for release, circle for the planet, circle for each soul, for the children of our children, keep the circle.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the sound of your own steps, the sound of your hereafter. Memory awaits and turns to greet you, draping its banner across your wrists. Wake up, arms, delicate feet, for as one to march the streets, each alone, each part of another, your steps shall ring, shall raise the cloud, and they that will hear, voice of the one and the one and the one, as it has never been uttered before. For something greater yet to come than the hour of the prophets in their great cities. For the people of Nineveh fell to their knees, heeding the cry of Jonah, united, covering themselves in sackcloth and ashes, and called to their God, and all their hearts were as one heart, and all their voices were as one voice. God heard them, and his mind was moved, yet something greater will come to pass, And who will call? And what will they call? Will they call to God, the air, the fowl? It will not matter if the call is true. They shall call, and this is known. One voice, and each another shall enter the dead, the living flower, enter forms that we know not, to be felt by sea, by air, by earth, and shall be an elemental pledge. This is our birthright, this is our charge, and we have given over to others, and they have not done well. And the forests mourn, the leaves fall, swaddling babes watch and wonder as the fathers of our spirit nations dance in the street in celebration, as the mountains turn pale from their nuclear hand, and they have not done well. Now, my children, you must overturn the tables, deliver the future from material rule. For only one rule should be considered, the 11th commandment, to love one another. And this is our covenant across your wrist. This offering is yours to adorn, adore, to bury, to burn, upon a mound, to hail, to set away. It is merely a cloth, merely our colors, invested with the blood of a people, all their hopes and dreams. Our flag, it has its excellence, yet it is nothing. It shall not be a tyranny above us, nor should God, nor love, nor nature. Yet we hold as our pleasure this tender honor that we acknowledge the individual and the common ground formed. And if our cloth be raised and lowered half-mast, what does it tell us? That an individual has passed, is saluted and mourned by his countrymen. This ritual extends to us all, for we are all the individual, no unknown, no insignificant one, nor insignificant labor, nor insignificant act of charity. Each has a story to be told and retold, which shall be a glowing thread in the fabric of man. And the children shall march and bring the colors forward, investing within them the redeeming blood of their revolutionary hearts.
And purified in my satin, but the balm of the season is a velvet revolution. I look at the sky and feel the tears of the prophets crying. I look at the sky and feel the rain, their rain of radical and cotton purified in my satin, but the balm of the season is a velvet revolution. All you killers of the children, there's a new commandment. The true divine creator wants a velvet revolution. All you killers of the children, there's a new commandment. The true divine creator wants a velvet revolution.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion and magical foray, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.